problems for this government is they haven't found a way of telling a compelling story about what they're doing and why they're governing in what interests. And the stakes are that high because at the moment, it does look like Nigel Farage is on course to be the next Prime Minister.
Well, we shall see. There's a lot to go yet, but we're certainly living in very strange times, that's for sure. Look, thank you for joining us and coming in today to Times Radio. Luke Sullivan there. That's it for me today. I'll be back tomorrow at 1 o'clock. But up next on Times Radio, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
On the programme today, well, Sir Keir Starmer said Peter Mandelson lied, lied and lied again. That was Keir Starmer in PMQs today. We'll discuss his handling of the situation with a former director of policy for him. Now, as more and more comes out about those connected to Jeffrey Epstein, we'll talk to investigative journalist Vicky Ward, who's been writing about Epstein for decades. There's change in the air here at Times Towers, and Ryan Tubridy will be here to tell us about his new Sunday afternoon show on Times Radio. And our big guest after 3:30 is a journalist, Steve Crawshaw, who'll be talking about his book, Prosecuting the Powerful, War Crimes and the Battle for Justice.
We hope you can stay with us for all of that. Let's get the latest news first with Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, Fee. Thank you. Sir Keir Starmer has admitted Peter Mandelson's continued friendship with Jeffrey Epstein was flagged to him during vetting when he made him ambassador to Washington. The Prime Minister says he regrets that appointment but insists Lord Mandelson misled him. He says the government will release those vetting documents to MPs.
I want to make sure this House sees the full documentation so it will see for itself the extent to which time and time again Mandelson completely misrepresented the extent of his relationship with Epstein and lied throughout the process.
MPs are currently debating the release of those documents, with the Conservatives accusing the government of trying to cover up information. That's because ministers say the documents should only be released if they don't prejudice national security or international relations. Some Labour MPs are calling for the documents to be looked at in full and redacted by a committee of MPs instead of civil servants. Times Radio's political editor Steve Swinford says the Prime Minister is in hot water.
And I think he's in a fight, potentially, for his political life here, because he has admitted there at the dispatch box that he appointed Mandelson as the ambassador despite knowing that he had an ongoing friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. And that is a really big issue here for Labour MPs and for the broader body politic. And I think he's in a lot of trouble this afternoon.
We will keep you up to date throughout the afternoon on Times Radio. Six Palestine Action activists have been cleared of aggravated burglary at a defence company linked to Israel. The break-in at Elbit Systems factory in Bristol happened in August 2024. The jury did not reach a verdict on a charge of grievous bodily harm and three of violent disorder, which some of the activists were facing. An 18-year-old has been arrested on suspicion of murder after a student was stabbed in Leicester city centre. The man in his 20s was found yesterday afternoon near De Montfort University, where police declared a very serious incident. The Scottish Labour leader is calling for an Australian-style ban on social media for under-16s in the UK.
Yes, they may feel a false connection to a social media personality, but what is happening to the human connections in their own household? Human connections at school. I think, sadly, for too many kids, mobile phones and social media has broken those human connections.
Anna Sawa wants the UK government to follow Australia and the likes of France, Spain and Denmark, which have also proposed bans. Downing Street says it's consulting on the idea. Scotland's First Minister John Swinney says he supports action to protect children online, but he has so far stopped short of backing a full ban. A deal's been agreed for the insurance giant Zurich to take over UK rival Beazley. The deal is £8 billion after the company dismissed an earlier one of £7.7 billion. It's only a deal in principle and a formal proposal is yet to be made. And a teenage boy's been given 6 points on his future driving licence for taking his parents' VW campervan for a joyride. The 13-year-old was caught on a dual carriageway in Poole in Dorset. His parents told a court he'll be washing cars for the next year to pay off £105 in court costs. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It is Jane Garvey, Fee Glover with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon. A very busy news slate for you. We will go straight in with a look back at PMQs. It wasn't to be missed today. We'll give you a full roundup of Keir Starmer's defence of himself in the face of mounting evidence of Peter Mandelson's fibbing. We have some new signings in a busy transfer window here at Times Towers. We're going to talk to Ryan Tubridy, who's joining to take over Sunday afternoons. He is making the descent from floor 17 as well, isn't he? It's a well-trodden path. Emma B yesterday, Ryan Tubridy today. We will look ahead to what his new Sunday show will contain. Good news on cancer, and we should really take some time to celebrate this. Three quarters would survive a cancer diagnosis by 2035 because of advances in medicine. But are we funded well enough to be able to reap the rewards of that new technology and the new understanding? We will talk about that with a top cancer expert in this half an hour of the programme too. TV news with Scott Bryan today. Nigella, the Muppets and ads in rugby. Vassos Alexander, he will come in every day to do, it's either called Thought Sport, Sport Thought, Pause for Thought. It's definitely not called Alexander the Great, but it'll probably end up being called Alexander the Great. And today he's going to talk about winter sport. Will he be glued to your screens for the Winter Olympics? They are in our time zone. We've got no excuses.
Fabulous. And apparently Team GB are set to do better than ever. Did you pay attention to the last Winter Olympics? Do you remember where they were? I'd completely forgotten where they were.
God, I want to say Beijing, but that must be a couple of Olympics ago, and probably a summer one, not a winter one. Where were they, Jane?
Well, I think they were in Russia, weren't they? 2022, because it was after that that... Oh, was it 2023? And after that, Russia invaded Ukraine. I think that's what happened.
I rather hope that you had a firm answer to the rhetorical question that you were punting
because
out.
Because I had written down that they were in China, but I'm sure they weren't in China.
OK, we'll find out. So, because it's not a great start to the show.
Hannah's the producer. We'll find out where they were. Now, I'm sure it was in Russia. There was definitely a Russian link because there was all sorts of rumours that Putin was waiting for the Olympics to be over. Yes. They were in Beijing. What? They were in Beijing. They were in Beijing. Right. But it was after that, of course, that Putin invaded Ukraine, which is in no way amusing. So Britain is supposed to, let's go back to where we started. Team GB are meant to have a record medals haul.
I tell you what, there are lots of people thinking, oh, thank God they've got a man and sort this out in the next hour of the programme. Will be here after 3:30?
Actually, a really interesting guest today. And it's a good time to talk about how it never seems to be the case that truly powerful people face justice. And this is the kind of justice that ought to be faced by some absolutely appalling global figures. Steve Crawshaw is the name of the journalist. He is someone who used to work for Human Rights Watch. He's been the chief foreign correspondent at The Independent. And he's written a very powerful book called Prosecuting the Powerful, War Crimes and the Battle for Justice. And on the cover of the book are three individuals, Putin, Netanyahu and Al-Assad. Assad is the only one who isn't in power. The other two are still operating, and lots of people obviously believe that they shouldn't be. And it's really interesting whether the International Criminal Court does have a great deal of sway. Certainly Donald Trump is not a big fan, and there are double standards at work here all kinds of hypocrisy going on. Steve Crawshaw should be very interesting after 3:30 today.
So that is all to come. We're 0333 at 00032353 if you'd like to participate. We always love hearing from you. And don't worry, we will get our facts in order, I promise. The most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. In at number three, crying child and oblivious parents ruined lunch, says ex-newsreader. Now, this is Jan Leeming. She complained about the parents of a screaming baby and a child wandering through the pig at Bridge Place. She thought they should have organised a babysitter. The second most read story, Epstein Files latest. Starmer knew Mandelson kept ties with Jeffrey Epstein. MPs are debating humble address, pushing for the release of files related to Mandelson's vetting for US ambassador. The most read piece on the Times website, my grandfather was a Catholic priest, and now I've written a novel about it. This is a review of the novel A Private Man. It tells the story of a young man who discovers that his grandmother once enjoyed an illicit affair with a priest. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe. And if you want a sneak preview of what's coming up in tomorrow's Times newspaper, even before it's gone to press, then you can do that by listening to the fabulous Kate Borsay on her evening edition as she brings you tomorrow's Times Today. You see, that's a great title.
Yeah, that is good. That
every
works.
Day, just before nine, Kate goes through the best bits of tomorrow's paper with one of the newspaper's most senior editors. So especially at the moment, don't miss it.
Yeah, and just to go back to what I tried to say at the beginning of the programme, Team GB are expected to do really well in the Winter Olympics, which is why Vassos is going to talk to us about that today. We're meant to get at least 8 medals, and this would be astonishing stuff for a country that, let's face it, doesn't have an enormous amount of snow. So that would be something.
And didn't we only get one last time round?
No, I did make a note of that. We got a 2.
Right. Do you know what sports they were in?
Curling. They were both in curling.
Excellent. OK. Yeah. Well, let's go for the 8. Fun times in Cortina.
Absolutely. And please do keep your thoughts coming, because we are going to talk about PMQs, and lots of you, I know, very exercised by what you heard, and indeed what you'll continue to hear in the House of Commons throughout the day, because all that is still going on. So Keir Starmer says his former US ambassador, Peter Mandelson, who, by the way, was only appointed on the 10th of February last year, so he didn't actually occupy the post for very long at all. He betrayed the UK and Parliament, says Sir Keir. The PM was challenged repeatedly over that appointment at PMQs today. And the question of what the scandal might mean for the fate of Starmer himself was put very clearly, it has to be said, by Plaid Cymru's Liz Saville-Roberts.
The victims and survivors of Epstein and his circle of overprivileged elite are at the forefront of my mind here and now. Mandelson, we now know, described Epstein's release from prison after being sentenced for child sex offences as Liberation Day. This man's association with Epstein was known when the Prime Minister personally appointed him as the UK's ambassador to the USA.
Yep.
How can we trust the Prime Minister's judgment? And in questioning that, how can we trust him to remain as Prime Minister?
Can I join her in the disgust in the comments that she just read out, but to be absolutely clear, the scale and the extent of the relationship between Mandelson and Epstein was not disclosed. On the contrary, it wasn't just not disclosed. Mandelson lied throughout the process and beyond the process. He lied, and he lied again to my team.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the Prime Minister didn't really acknowledge the second part of that question from Liz Saville-Roberts. The Tory party is currently using its opposition day to demand the release of files relating to Mandelson's appointment. Now, the government says it will comply with this, but there will be redactions on the grounds of national security and national interest. So that is what is being debated in the Commons right now. Our guest for PMQs this week is Claire Ainslie, was a policy director to Keir Starmer, and she's now at the Progressive Policy Institute. Claire, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
This is, to say the least, a tricky time for the government. Do you think, honestly, Keir Starmer can survive this?
I think we will have to see. I mean, I share the comments and the emotion, I think, conveyed by Liz Saville-Roberts in the House. I mean, this is just sickening. the crimes that are committed, these disclosures that we're now seeing all over the internet of what Epstein put his victims through, and then compounded by the complicity of these powerful men who either were party to the crimes themselves or allowed it to go on, either turned a blind eye or indulged it in some way. And I feel emotional talking about it. I think it's just absolutely sickening. And I think, you know, regardless of the Prime Minister's future, the important thing is we have to remember that these women are at the heart of it, and they deserve accountability, whoever is at the end of that. So I think we put the women first. But when it comes to politicians, you know, absolutely, I think there are questions to be asked about the appointment of Peter Mandelson. And I'm glad to hear what I heard today, which is full disclosure.
Yeah, well, full disclosure with some redactions that the government says are absolutely essential on the grounds of national security. But in a way, that's slightly in the weeds of the conversation we want to have now. I'm really glad that you mentioned your concern for the victims. And absolutely, that's something that Fi and I would also emphasise. But we do have to talk about the politics, and we do have to talk about the judgment of our Prime Minister, who has said, he said today that he knew that Mandelson had kept up a friendship with Epstein and yet still gave him this extraordinary opportunity. The best job in the diplomatic service. Honestly, Claire, what was he thinking?
Well, I mean, I wasn't director of policy and I wasn't advising the Prime Minister.
Well, tell us, I mean, the Keir Starmer,
just to be really clear, I'm not here to account for Keir Starmer's decision making on it. I'm here to, as a guest on your programme, to do that. So I'm not here to make those, you know, defend that case. I think there are real questions to be asked, and I'm happy that we will get that full disclosure in this Opposition Day debate. I think it's really serious. I think it is really, really serious. I think we need to see the full facts laid out of what questions were asked, what due diligence was undertaken, what reassurances were received, and if they were not satisfactory, why they then went ahead with that appointment. So I share, you know, in every way, I share the concern that everybody else has about the decision making around that.
Let's just have a listen to what the Prime Minister said today at PMQs. And he went for, well, anger. I mean, he was really keen to put distance between himself and the appalling behaviour of Mandelson. Let's have a listen.
Leaking sensitive information at the height of the response to the 2008 crash is beyond infuriating. And I am as angry as the public and any member of this House. Mandelson betrayed our country, our Parliament and my party. Mr. Speaker, he lied repeatedly to my team when asked about his relationship with Epstein before and during his tenure as ambassador. I regret appointing him. If I knew then what I know now, he would never have been anywhere near government.
What do you think of that, Claire?
I think we need to know what he knew at the time. And that is obviously going to come out in the disclosure of these, we can call it papers now, but whatever the correspondence is. So I think it's the line, obviously, that the Prime Minister is taking is Mandelson lied to him, and he lied to, well, he lied to his officials when he asked for those reassurances. And we're going to need the proof of that. And then we're going to need to ask that question of what was known at the time and whether that was satisfactory. And I think that's where the questions are. So I felt about PMQs today, it set the scene for those disclosures. It didn't really, I don't think, tell us a huge amount more about what had been contained within that, because actually we knew some of this information back in September.
OK, and we'll just have a listen to the leader of the opposition, Kemi Badenoch, who, well, her tone was kind of more in sorrow than in anger. She was pretty measured, actually. But here she is challenging the PM on whether he knew about Epstein's links. Here we are.
He did know. It was on Google. If the Conservative Research Department could find this information out, why couldn't Number 10? Yeah. On the 10th of September, when we knew this, I asked him at that dispatch box, he gave Mandelson his full confidence at that dispatch box, not once, but twice. He only sacked him after pressure from us. I am asking the Prime Minister something very specific, not about the generalities of the full extent. Can the Prime Minister tell us, did the official security vetting he received mention Mandelson's ongoing relationship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein?
So clear. Prime Minister.
Yes, it did. As a result, various questions were put to him. I intend to disclose to this House all of the national security, prejudice to international relations on one side. I want to make sure this House sees the full documentation so it will see for itself the extent to which time and time again Mandelson completely misrepresented the extent of his relationship with Epstein and lied throughout the process, including in response to the due diligence.
So there we are, Claire. That was Keir Starmer answering that question. It couldn't be any clearer. He did know about his continuing friendship. And I think if you are aware too, as I'm sure the Prime Minister was, of Mandelson's previous stints in government, the man had form. Alarm bells should have been going off all over the place, but still he got the job. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think there is more to come. I mean, I felt that the Kemi Badenoch's questioning was clearly opening it up so that if there is full disclosure and there is more in those emails and they just said, oh, well, we can just put this information to one side. She's made that attack. But she also has said, really, on the basis of what we already know, I'm going to ask this question. So I don't think PMQs was the decider, if you like, today. As I say, I think it set the scene for what we're about to find out. And I don't know, actually, the Leader of Opposition knows what's in those emails either.
No.
She left that open, really, yeah, for a future attack. But absolutely, I agree with you in terms of the questions that were being asked. Was the reassurance fulsome? Was the reassurance then evidenced? And really, will it come down to a question of can they prove that Mandelson lied? And even so, is there a remaining question about the judgment of being put into this incredibly important relationship? As you say, the ambassador's role is incredibly important with a very fragile international situation as well. So I think that those that raised those questions at the time, even without knowing what we know now, I think will feel that their questioning of the appointment was more than vindicated by what we now know.
But do you think, is it too terrible a thought to ponder whether or not he got the job precisely because he was linked to Epstein and to these privileged, well-connected, though we now know, utterly hideous circles?
I mean, I hadn't put that together in that way. I think the argument was made for his appointment that he would be the person that would be able to smooth relationships with the Trump administration. However, you will also know that there was a British ambassador already in there, Karen Pearce, who was also thought to have been doing a very good job already. So I don't know. And as I say, I wasn't working for the Prime Minister at the time that appointment was made. So I can't tell you the answer as to why that appointment was made. The justification we heard was that he was uniquely placed to fulfil that responsibility of smoothing relationship. But my questions were at the time, actually, I thought, well, actually, you've got a current ambassador who's doing a very good job. Surely you would make sure that you had continuity where you could. So, yeah, I think there's lots of questions. This is obviously not going to be done and dusted today. And I think the Prime Minister knew that when he answered those questions, that this is going to run for a very long time to come.
Will Keir Starmer still be Prime Minister this time next week, do you think?
Yes, I think he will do, but that's not to say necessarily I know what's in those emails and what comes out of what time frame. So I think we've got some way to go. But yeah, I think if I was in number 10, I would be absolutely putting this at the top of the priority list and making sure that the public cannot view this as some kind of cover up, exactly as my former colleague Luke Sullivan just said on this on the Ford programme, that this is absolutely what the public look at politicians and they look at these elites and they imagine like a wild conspiracy. You could not make this stuff up, and we cannot give any more truck to the populist right that actually this is part of democracy. This is, we should say, an isolated example, but people will only believe that if there's full accountability and justice for the women involved.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. That's Claire Ainslie, who was a policy director to Keir Starmer, now at the Progressive Policy Institute.
A few of our listeners are making exactly that point, actually, about Dame Karen Pearce. I'll read you just one. It shouldn't be forgotten that when appointing Mandelson in a political appointment, Starmer replaced Dame Karen Pearce, who was a very good US ambassador, who was well regarded by Trump and his administration. And she did indeed have good relations within the Republican Party. At the time, though, the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, and this is back in 2024, that's Pat McFadden, he said at the moment she's doing an excellent job. She's got the full confidence of the British government. We want her to keep on doing the job that she's doing. I think she's going to be a very important interlocutor and advisor for the UK government in this period of transition. I can't say exactly when her term will end. Well, Pat, obviously didn't say that loudly enough. And look what's happened now. She's overseeing the Western Balkans at the moment.
Have you seen Nick's message? I feel for Nick. He says, I've got a mate who's a complete conspiracy theorist. Always try and calm him down. But this is difficult. Yes, I bet it must be extremely difficult if you are a prox adjacent to a conspiracy theorist. This must be very, very tough indeed. It's hard enough for the rest of us, isn't
it? Yeah, we've moved over. The effervescent Ryan Tubridy is joining Times Radio. He's going to tell us what he has in store for his new Sunday afternoon programme in a couple of moments' time. 24 minutes past two, you're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit your local Wix store.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
We'll be bringing you all the news, the analysis, the opinions. God knows where it will lead us on Times Radio Breakfast from 6.
We have Heidi Alexander, the Transport Secretary, joining us for half an hour to answer all of your questions from 9.30. Send them to studio@times.radio.
And it's a Thursday, so we'll get all the best letters read in all the best voices from the Times.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
What is it that makes a Fred Olsen cruise feel like no other? Perhaps it's the awe-inspiring destinations that will stay with you forever, or our ships that are small in size but big in character. It could be the wonderful people you meet along the way, or our extraordinary crew. Maybe it's all of these things together. But if you really want to know what a Fred Olsen cruise feels like, there's only one way to find out.
The Philly cheesesteak is back at McDonald's and it's still intensely cheesy. Imagine the cheesiest thing ever. Now cover it in cheese. Add two beef patties, cheddar cheese sauce, crispy onions and even more cheese. The Philly cheesesteak. Did we mention it's cheesy? Available until the 16th of March 2026 from 11 a.m. Fees apply to delivery orders. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
The Story. The award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. The experts in bathrooms. From a shiny new tap to a full bathroom renovation, Wix has everything you need for every style of home. Browse thousands of bathroom products at wix.co.uk.
26 minutes past two, so there are some changes afoot here at Times Radio, especially at the weekends. Your Saturday afternoons will now echo to the sensual tones of Jane Mulkerens, Associate Editor of the Times magazine. And on Sunday afternoons, broadcaster Ryan Tubridy will be here to guide you through the very end of your week. The wonderful Rosie Wright is joining the Weekend Breakfast Show team alongside Callum McDonald. And Ryan Tubridy joins us now. Ryan, very good afternoon, colleague.
Well, who knew? As you said a little earlier on, the descent from 417 continued the pace. I enjoyed Emma B chatting away about her the marathon woman as she is now. And of course, Vasas also.
I know. Too many of you.
I know.
And as far as I know, Ryan, we're not sending anybody up there. What's going on?
It's all one-way traffic by the sound of things. Yeah.
Let's hear from you, though, what is going to be in your Sunday afternoon programme.
Well, for starters, obviously we'll maintain the newsy edge that is the kind of the bread and butter of Times Radio. But also, One thing I love, whether it's your show or indeed with Kate and Stig in the mornings, is there's always a kind of a bookish thread through the programmes. Everyone likes reading, it seems, in Times Radio. So we'll be focusing a lot on reading, literature, books, and obviously the authors and so forth. That's kind of my thing, really, that I love more than anything else, as well as American, UK and European politics. So that'll all be in the mix. If you can imagine the Sunday Times, which we all take, obviously, on a Sunday, look at the supplement, particularly whether it's travel, or what's on TV or what's in pop culture or culture broadly speaking, that'll be the sense of it. It won't have the... We'll have had Adam before us, obviously, and he will have that forensic eye on the politics of the day, the week, the weekend or whatever, and then we're in after that to mix things up a little bit. So yeah, we kick off on the 22nd of March, which is about 5 days after St. Patrick's Day, so I should be recovered enough at that point to take the helm, and off we go.
Sunday afternoons, I think, Ryan, are a particularly tricky time because you've got to get the energy level exactly right, haven't you? Because you do have to reflect the fact that an awful lot of people, it's their last kind of wind down before the week starts up again. But you don't want to be kind of sleepy in your schedule either.
Yes. Yeah, you're dead right. It's about getting that tone absolutely right. You don't also want to be the energy bunny who's driving people mad by being too much. And you don't want to put them to sleep by being a little too... So you're right. You've got to catch it right in the middle. And that's why I think that's the idea of the supplement type thing, whether it's talking about travel, nice and easy enough conversation, but with a kind of a smart twist to it, should be of interest to people. Like books, for example, books-wise, I think you guys enjoyed The Names by Florence Knapp, which was my favourite book of 2025. It's just a terrific book. And there's a new one coming out that we're hopefully going to talk about called Good People by Padmina Sabit. And it's just catching those things in advance and saying, have you heard about this one? Have you seen this thing? And getting the conversation going.
Yeah.
Everyone for direction.
I love The Names by Florence Knapp. For people who haven't read it yet, it's just such an amazing concept, isn't it, to imagine the difference that a name makes to a life. And it was so brilliantly pulled off, don't you think?
It was the cleverness of it. Caught me by surprise. I love coming to a book fresh, like a blank check. I don't like to read too many of the reviews, if you like. And every chapter, the first three chapters began with three very different scenarios. What happens when she names this baby a different name? And then after that, every alternative chapter tells you the fate of that child as they become an adolescent, become an adult. And it's a ferocious book, masquerading almost as an easy read, but it's not. It's challenging. It's smart. It's accessible, bizarrely. It'll be sadly relatable for a lot of people, but it's just one of those magnificent books that pop out in a certain year. I think this one I mentioned, The Good People, is going to be something like that. If you like The Names, you're going to love that. I've been kind of previewing a few proof copies of books. I'm sure you're doing the same. 2026 is just alive with great writing and great authors. And somebody like Neil Jordan, for example, will be joining us. He's the film director who won an Oscar for the screenplay of The Crying Game. And he's written his first ever science fiction novel, which I've finished a couple of days. And that's beautifully bonkers. And it's capturing the AI wave as well. So, and then weirdly, I'd love to talk about something. For example, the other evening, like so many others, I was kind of doom scrolling, if you will, on Netflix, of all things. And I came across a program. I don't know if either of you have seen a program called Accused. Not The Accused, but Accused. And it was made in about 2012. And there were standalone episodes starring the best actors. I mean, you've got Stephen Graham is in there, and Sheridan Smith is in there, and Robert Sheehan and Sean Bean. I mean, remarkable actors. And it's a self-contained episode of this amazing crime drama, if you like. And it passed me by completely the first time around, and I've been talking about it for the last week, and people are going back to watch it. And it's just, it's amazing TV, great drama. And I'd love to know, you know, who finds these things? Who even in Netflix decides, let's go back and discover who did that, and who let's bring it back to another audience. And it's going behind the scenes a little bit, and trying to break through the noise of what's on offer and come up with the good stuff.
Well, Ryan, we're going to look to you for exactly those kind of cultural tidbits. Don't be too good. That would be our advice to you, if that's okay.
And fear of that, I can tell you.
Well, oh, don't be daft. And we will fight you for the authors. That's Ryan Tubridy. His show will start later on in March. Now, people are worried about Chloe Tilley and Alexis Conran going. They're moving on to pastures new. Alexis Conran is one of the hardest working men in showbiz. Anyway, he's on Channel 5 5 days a week. How he was ever managing to do seven days a week is beyond us.
Lucky to have him. He was doing air fryers. He's such a good broadcaster, actually.
He is, yep. So, all change on the 20th of March here on Times Radio.
Right. And Ryan has his admirers. I thought he was very shy, but I think he might be able to string a few words together on his programme. Looking forward to that hugely. All starts in March here on Times Radio. Now, promises of a revolution in cancer care. Can the government deliver? That's in a couple of moments. We'll also talk telly, more telly, actually. We've had that good recommendation from Ryan. We're going to talk telly with Scott Bryan before 3 o'clock. Here are the headlines. Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Sir Keir Starmer has admitted Peter Mandelson's continued friendship with Jeffrey Epstein was flagged to him when he made an ambassador to Washington. The Prime Minister has told MPs that was raised during vetting, but he insists Lord Mandelson repeatedly lied to him. He also says the government will release those vetting documents. The Times' political editor Stephen Swinford says the Prime Minister needs to be vindicated by them.
The only lifeline Starmer has here is he is now saying Mandelson lied to me about that. That is what all that Starmer has got to defend himself is to say, I was misled. Well, was he when it was there in black and white that there was an ongoing relationship? And at the end of the day, he put a friend of a paedophile as Britain's man in Washington. That's it. It's that simple.
The Conservatives accuse the government of trying to cover up decisions by redacting some of those documents. Ministers say that is to make sure they don't prejudice national security or international relations. Six Palestine Action activists have been cleared of aggravated burglary over a break-in at an Israeli arms company. They're on trial over an incident at Elbit Systems factory in Bristol in August 2024. An 18-year-old has been arrested on suspicion of murder after a student was stabbed in Leicester City Centre. The man in his 20s was found near De Montfort University yesterday afternoon. And the eldest son of Norway's crown princess has cried while giving evidence in his trial where he's accused of raping four women. Marius Borg Høiby is facing 38 charges in total, including abusing and assaulting his former girlfriend and partners. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
We travel to explore, to learn, to connect. At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Our itineraries are designed to help you explore and engage with your destination through its food, culture, and customs. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please, go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead, Saturday and Sunday from 10 p.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Wix local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or with a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wix.co.uk.
It is 24 minutes to three. Currently, you are more likely to survive certain cancers in countries like Sweden, Norway, Romania or Greece. But the government here is promising a technological revolution that could see three quarters of cancer patients live through the disease. The pledge is part of the new National Cancer Plan. Wes Streeting told Times Radio Breakfast why he thinks it is achievable.
The reason we're confident we're going to be able to do that are the steps we're setting out in the plan to harness the revolution that's taking place in medical science and technology that enables us to diagnose earlier, treat more effectively, and with the breakthroughs we're seeing in genomics, we're going to be able to predict and potentially even prevent illness. I mean, people are talking about cancer vaccines. That's how exciting the science is in this area. But to reassure people, you won't need to be waiting till 2035 to see progress. During the course of this parliament, we want to see our cancer standards met once again, whether that is the faster diagnosis standard of receiving either a diagnosis or an all clear within 28 days, or going from referral to treatment within 62 days. Now, at the moment, we're hitting the faster diagnosis standard. We've been hitting that in our first year. I'm pleased with that, but I'm not satisfied yet because we're not meeting all standards consistently.
Well, let's talk through all of that with Claire Turnbull, Professor of Translational Cancer Genetics at the Institute for Cancer Research. Claire, first of all, what are translational cancer genetics?
So, good afternoon, Fee. So, translational cancer genetics, I do, I'm a clinician in the NHS, but I also do research to try and bring genetic testing into the NHS where it's useful and benefits patients.
How does it benefit cancer patients?
So there's lots of areas, and genomics was a big theme both in the overall 10-year plan and then also in the cancer plan released today. So we can use genomics, particularly in cancer, to we study the tumour and try to identify changes in the tumour, which will tell us how best to treat it. Emerging are blood tests where you can detect DNA from the tumour and sequence it, which means you don't need to do an invasive biopsy to see whether the tumour has come back or not. The area I work in particularly is looking at the DNA that we're born with to identify cancer risks. So you may have heard of BRCA1 mutations, for example, Angelina Jolie. And those are people where we can find the gene change in the family and give them intensive screening or even surgery to remove the organs at risk to mitigate their very high inherited risk of cancer. So that's a little 30-second summary of where we use genomics in
right.
cancer care.
Well, I think that's absolutely brilliant, because if we talk about it with these big phrases like the age of personalised medicine, I think we are not entirely clear about what that might mean to us. But also, and forgive my kind of, civilian attitude to this, Claire, but some of the stuff that you've talked about there, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, that must be so much more expensive to actually do than the one size hopefully fits all and helps some of the all way that we treat cancer at the moment. Am I right to think that?
I think you are completely right. And actually, this is embodied in the cancer plan, that there are some areas in which we just need to do what we've known how to do for decades, and we need to tighten it up and we need to do it better. And as a surgeon I used to work for used to say, once you suspect a cancer, the clock is ticking before you get that cancer out and into a bucket. And that's why it's all about cancer pathways. As soon as someone has symptoms, they need to get an appointment with a GP. They need to be referred in for the diagnostic test. They need a diagnosis. They need the staging test. And nearly all cancers that are going to be cured are cured with surgery and on occasion radiotherapy. And that pathway hasn't changed. And as you say, in some senses, that is somewhat of a one-size-fits-all pathway. And we should not lose sight of just squeezing down those timelines of getting, as soon as someone has symptoms, they need to be able to get to a GP, get referred in, get their scan, and get to surgery. And that's not necessarily usually any kind of fancy robotic surgery. For the most part, these are all very straightforward tests that haven't particularly changed. So I think the performance ambitions and the meeting the targets will need to remember that most people are going through that pretty standard pathway. But on top of that, there is some application of genomics and new technologies and cancer vaccines and so forth, which leverage fantastic new technology, but it's somewhat uncharted the degree to that will have an impact on
right.
a greater scale.
So yeah. We'll come to those in just a couple of moments. But what is your thought about the reality of Wes Streeting's ambition just in terms of that pathway you've described to us? I mean, is the reason why you are more likely to survive certain cancers in other countries because they just get the cancer in the bucket quicker?
To some extent they do. And then it's how you can change that. And I think some ways, so there's a lot of emphasis on there, for example, on AI. And AI will help in some areas. So pathology, a real bottleneck is pathology. We don't have enough pathologists, and some of their techniques are very slow. They have to look at dozens of slides under a microscope. So AI in pathology potentially allows you to scan through the two-thirds that are completely normal and save the pathologist for the potentially abnormal minority. The same with imaging and radiology, that if you can use AI to scan through the thousands and thousands of images from breast screening, you can save your radiologist. So I think those things are where the technology is clearly applicable. There's stuff there about workforce. We have far too few doctors, but we can train up allied healthcare professionals to do roles like endoscopy, train up the radiographers to do some of the radiologist tasks. So I think, again, those are really good elements of the plan. Neighbourhood diagnostics, trying to get the tests to where people need them. Have MRI scanners working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. Figure out where your bottlenecks are on that pathway to getting the tumour in the bucket. So all of those are sensible, practical deliverables. And I think if we can put lots of focus on workforce, community diagnostics, improving pathology and sensible leveraging of technology, I think we can really tighten those timelines. And the more we tighten those timelines, the better the outcomes, the higher the survival.
Sure. So we take all of that on board, but in a sense, delivery mechanisms aren't sexy. When you say something like cancer vaccines, that sounds sexy. And that you have already mentioned, you know, that does seem to crop up quite a bit, especially when Wes Streeting is talking about new things that are available on the horizon. But are we, I don't know, where on the horizon is that?
You're completely right. The technology is absolutely fantastic. The technology behind cancer vaccines, the technology behind these multi-cancer early detection blood, urine, breath tests, robotics, all of these are amazing technology, and they potentially will have quite niche applications, but they're not going to transform the way we diagnose and treat cancers. And I think that there's a lot of excitement because the technology works for a particular application or transforms a particular cancer type, but it's often quite a sort of small single cancer type. And then the promise of the technology gets overly hyped, and sort of and I think the public rightly get disillusioned because they open the paper and two or three times a week there's some amazing technology that's going to transform cancer care, but their reality is that they're waiting on a trolley in A&E, and it doesn't seem to translate to their lives.
And so when would that change? Is it simply a matter of time that might bring costs down for all of those things that might, you know, we just might have experienced more of those things, say, in 10, 20 years time? Would that be a realistic, hopeful time frame?
I think some things will translate into the NHS over that time scale. And some of them we're already using. But as I said, we're using them in maybe the one or two scenarios in which they are effective. But I think it's unlikely cancer vaccines are going to transform the treatment of the majority of cancers. I think it's unlikely that blood or breath tests are going to make a dramatic impact on cancer screening. It may be that in certain scenarios, or we whittle them down or we improve them, they have a bit more impact. But again, it's a bit like the British cycling team, that I think some of these things with maturity may shave off a percent or two on our targets. But that's why we need to, as you've sort of recognised, we need to concentrate on the very unsexy processes of gluing that pretty standard pathway together and tightening it up, and then anticipate there will be some little areas where we can sprinkle on the high-tech additions, but that they are not something we should be relying on.
And of course, the really uncomfortable truth, Claire, is that we also need to take care of ourselves, don't we? We need to have a personal responsibility about how we treat our bodies in order to try and effect the best outcomes for ourselves. You know, obesity and cancer are related, aren't they? And, so where do you think our collective heads are on that?
So again, these are not things that are new. Tobacco, food, obesity, sunbeds, air pollution, HPV vaccination. So all of these are things we can address through public health. They are all laid out well, and I celebrate the fact they are mentioned in the cancer plan. They tend to be, again, areas that are not politically so attractive to pump money into, because you don't, it's quite difficult to count the cancers that were avoided that never happened. And people individually don't recognise a cancer that was prevented. They'll be very relieved by a cancer that's detected early on screening or successfully treated. But they're not so, you know, able to appreciate the value of preventative medicine because you don't see the disease. But those, again, if you can just shift that distribution curve for the population a tiny little bit over to the right, i.e. fewer exposures, you have very sizable impacts. Particularly obesity affects a multitude of cancer types, as does smoking, as does HPV. So all of these things, if you can get good public health programs, but again, they're expensive and they're long term, and the rewards are not as visible.
Well, it's very good to talk to you, Claire. Thank you very much indeed. Claire Turnbull is Professor of Translational Cancer Genetics at the Institute for Cancer Research. I mean, I have to say there could not have been a worse day for Wes Streeting to try and talk about the new National Cancer Plan, because there were so many other, and are still so many other, very distracting, some people would say selfish from the people involved in it, things on the table. So it is very good to talk to a clinician about what all of that means for all of us.
Yes. Now, with John Pienaar, between 4 o'clock and seven, he's got, as ever, a cracking lineup of contributors. And tonight is going to be interesting because he's going to be speaking to the Attorney General of Poland on Poland's investigation into possible links between Jeffrey Epstein and Russian authorities. And Sir Ed Davey is also talking to John Pienaar tonight, leader of the Liberal Democrats, and he asked a question in PMQs about exactly that today. So that will be intriguing, all with John, between 4 o'clock and seven tonight here on Times Radio. Next with us, we've got the king of the telly, Scott Bryan, here to talk about the return to screens of one of TV's top food stars, I would say. She's the twinkling fairy on top of the cooking television Christmas tree. And she's back. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
How I Made It on Times Radio with Sky Business Mobile. Join Ed Vasey and Associate Business Editor of the Sunday Times, Hannah Privett, every Friday morning as they capture the human stories behind the entrepreneurs who have built their businesses from startup to startling success. How I Made It, every Friday morning with Ed Vasey on Times Radio with Sky Business Mobile. Only Sky Business Mobile rolls over unused data and automatically shares it with your team. See skybusiness.com for T's and C's and verification.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking. Exploring the world in comfort.
Turn ordinary into the extraordinary every day with the Lexus LBX. Whilst most SUVs are big and brash, the LBX is quietly bold and confident. Refined luxury crafted into a compact SUV. The Lexus LBX, What Car's Best Small SUV 2024 and 2025.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Scott Bryan is Britain's leading television critic. Hello, Scott, how are you?
Afternoon, yeah, good, thanks. How are you?
Not too bad at all. Now, look, this is going to really upset some people who love their rugby. ITV has confirmed it's going to show ads during the play in the Six Nations, which I think starts on the weekend, Friday, I think, actually. How is this going to work?
Yeah, so the Times had this report earlier today to say that there will be an advert shown perhaps in like a split L-shaped sort of mode. So you'll still be able to see the play, but adverts will be appearing on the outside in the bit before Scrum takes place. You know, there's always a bit of a, there isn't so much sporting action during those periods. So I think for ITV, they feel that there is a commercial opportunity. And they've also partnered with two brands that will be showing it. I mean, I think it's rather interesting. Obviously, it's going to frustrate quite a lot of fans. But I would also say, and this is echoing a piece also on the Times by Owen Slott this afternoon, that, I mean, it's probably necessary to keep both the sporting tournament on terrestrial TV. Yeah. More and more sporting events are now ending up behind a very high paywall of more than £30 a month or so. There have been a commitment by both the BBC and ITV to be airing for Six Nations over the course of the next few years. But more and more sports are ending up slowly being curtailed off free-to-air TV and ending up behind a paywall one way or another. Even the Commonwealth Games, unthinkable a few years ago, are mostly going to be behind TNT Sports, and the BBC are only really going to have highlight packages. So I think to people's frustration, I think it's a fact that this is the way to keep the sport at a time when commercial channels like ITV are finding it harder.
Well, I'm interested to hear how that looks and indeed how it's all received. I got it wrong. The Six Nations starts tomorrow, as Colin points out. Thank you, Colin. Ireland, he says, the mighty Ireland against France at 8:10 tomorrow night. There's no danger of these ads appearing during the football in the summer then, presumably?
No, the World Cup is exempt from this because they would have to go to FIFA direct. I mean, I would also say the ads are not going to be as intense as, let's say, you would have during the Super Bowl, where there seems to be ads every 2 to 3 seconds. In fact, sometimes I wonder that when the coverage is on the BBC late at night or other channels, I would want to see the Super Bowl ads, but we can't get that over here.
OK, I'm quite intrigued to know who's going to be advertising, because this will be as the scrum kind of assembles. And you're right, it can take a little bit of time. Everyone to get into position. So what's going to be attempted to be sold at us in those moments? Something sporty?
Yeah, so according to the report on the Times, it's the Samsung Galaxy and Virgin Atlantic. So nothing to do with sport whatsoever.
Okay, well, that's weird. Okay, well, thank you anyway. Now, Fee and I have both enjoyed the Take That documentary. I think Fee's finished. I've got one more to go. It is very, very winning, this series of documentaries, three of them, about the life and times of Take That. Have you seen it, Scott?
I have. I mean, I would say I'm in two minds about it. I think there's been a long line of documentaries that look at the rise and fall of pop bands in a heartfelt way. I think about 10 years ago, these sort of documentaries were seen to be, or any look back of the 90s and noughties were seen to be a bit of sort of fluff, essentially. And now I think they look at how society's values have changed, how the way the press operates changed, how fame has negative sides as well as positive sides. I think the mentality in British society used to be, well, you have nothing to complain about, you're rich and famous. And I think this documentary highlights that you can have real problems. And I think also the best part of this documentary, I think, is the second episode, where they talk about how when the pop band splits up, when Take That splits up, and then you try acting, you know, maybe the second thing you've always wanted to do, and then that doesn't work out, where do you go? And your career is essentially over at the age of 25. You might have a bit of money, but you're always going to be remembered for the thing you did in your early 20s. Mm-hmm. And I think I would be horrified if I was only remembered for the things I did in my early 20s. So I think it does that well. I think my only frustration is perhaps I have heard the Take That story, plus also the feuds between Robbie and Gary, so many times before. I'm not sure whether I have the same stomach to see it again.
Listen, just be grateful you did do something in your early 20s, because I didn't. So that wouldn't be, you know, there's
nothing. Oh, don't be ridiculous.
No, I didn't.
Yes, you did.
No, I didn't.
You were doing a breakfast show at Hereford and Worcester. It's not nothing.
Thank you for speaking up for me. Right, let's move on to Bake Off. By the way, there's Netflix. It's Netflix who are showing those Take That documentaries, and I did think they were definitely 7.5 out of 10. Bake Off welcomes Nigella Lawson. Now, this is a cracking booking. I think everybody knew it was coming. Is the format going to be tweaked at all? I have to say, I've not really watched it for a while. It was just getting a little bit samey for me.
I mean, it has been quite samey for a while, I'd say. I mean, I don't think they will change the format that much. I think they would see Nigella being introduced as enough of a change in itself. I think Channel 4 maybe are quite resistant to making too many changes just because it is still, by and large, one of Channel 4's most popular programmes. I think next to Taskmaster, and manages to bring in so much commercial revenue. So I think... I mean, this is the way the show's always been. It sort of ebbed and flowed a little bit. But I think for Nigella, the fact that, you know, there's only been two other judges, Mary Berry and, of course, Prue Leaf, and they've all had to be national treasure status. For me, I think it's just the innuendo possibilities are going to be endless with the fact you've got Bake Off and Nigella in the same place.
Yes, she does do a good... saucy flirt, doesn't she, Nigella? So she'll be in her element in that tent. And a quick word about The Muppet Show, which has released a special 30-minute episode today, only on Disney Plus. What's this?
It's a joy. So there have been a lot of talk about bringing back The Muppet Show. All of the episodes are available already from the original run. It's a bit of a British institution, actually. Jim Henson came to the UK to make the show after no US network would, and it ended up being having, I think, more than 150 million viewers, so a huge show of the 70s and early 80s. So they've brought it back, and what they've done with this one-off, I think it's a pilot essentially, is keep it exactly the same. They've not tried to update it or make it cool or hip. They bring in Sabrina Carpenter, who performs one of her songs surrounded by the Muppet Chickens, and that's where the comedy goes.
Right.
But it is literally when you see them sing the traditional lines and the curtain goes up and you see Statler and Waldorf making their sort of snarky comment, part of the, I had shivers, like part of your nostalgia. The nostalgia is so high in this because you just remember watching it when you were a kid. A delight.
Any more to come then?
Not confirmed yet, but I would say by the pretty much resounding positive reviews from it, I would say inevitable. But they've not filmed it in North London because it was filmed in North London last time. This time it's very much filmed in LA.
Right. I had no idea that The Muppets was a British, had any kind of British link. Scott, thank you very much indeed. Scott Bryan, who will join us next Wednesday to talk more telly. Perhaps we can get stuck into the Winter Olympics with him next week.
I'm sure we will. Do you know, I think that Paul Hollywood will have met his match with Nigella.
Yes,
I look forward to seeing it.
I wonder if Paul's hitting the gym. What do you think? It's almost 3 o'clock. It's time we like, as we head towards three, just a music play. Here we go.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
And it is gorgeous music. It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. In the next hour of our programme, Donald Trump has called for Americans to move on from the Epstein files. We'll be joined by investigative journalist Vicky Ward on what could still be to come. The Winter Olympics have kicked off with news of injured competitors and minion-themed figure skating routines. We'll get the very latest with our sportsman Vassos Alexander. And how can we hold hugely powerful men to account? It's a question we've been discussing throughout today's show, and in particular we'll do it with our big guest journalist Steve Crawshaw. We'll be discussing his book Prosecuting the Powerful: War Crimes and the Battle for Justice. Let's get the news first with Tom Noonan.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister has admitted Peter Mandelson's vetting to be US ambassador did flag his continued friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. Sir Keir Starmer's told MPs Lord Mandelson lied to him and his team repeatedly over his links to the paedophile. He says the government will release those vetting documents, providing that they don't prejudice national security or international relations. But the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says that'll be a whitewash.
We know that there will be a cover-up because this implicates the Prime Minister and his Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, a protégé of Peter Mandelson. The Prime Minister chose to inject Mandelson's poison into the heart of his government on the advice of Morgan McSweeney.
MPs are currently debating releasing those vetting documents, with some from all parties asking for MPs, not civil servants, to decide how to redact them. Sir Keir Starmer's former political director, Luke Sullivan, says it's a moment of real danger for the government.
Speaking to colleagues, I think there is concern about where this goes, but we also saw from the Prime Minister his attempt to throw the kitchen sink at trying to shut this down. And I think his actions, the level of actions he's taken, shows he recognises the danger for him and the government.
Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor has left his mansion in Windsor to go to a temporary home in the Sandringham estate. It's thought he left quietly on Monday evening following his photo being in the Epstein files and a fresh allegation from a woman who says Jeffrey Epstein sent her to have sex with a then prince. Royal correspondent Sarah Hewson explains how the prince's behaviour was the final straw.
To see Andrew living his life, carrying on with his life in the grandeur of the Windsor estate, riding his horse, waving to passers-by almost as if he's saying goodbye on a sort of farewell parade around the Windsor estate, felt very unpalatable.
Six Palestine Action activists have been cleared of aggravated burglary at a factory of an Israeli arms company. They're charged with a raid at a defence firm Elbit in Bristol in August 2024. A jury was unable to reach verdicts on criminal damage allegations and the allegation that one of the defendants inflicted grievous bodily harm on a police sergeant. An 18-year-old man has been arrested on suspicion of murder after a student was stabbed to death in Leicester city centre. The victim, in his 20s, was found yesterday afternoon close to De Montfort University's campus. A former vet has pleaded guilty to drugging his wife so she wouldn't wake up while he poisoned and abused children. 76-year-old John Rubin previously admitted sexually assaulting two boys at a summer camp in Leicestershire last July and cruelty towards six other victims. The drugs giant GSK has revealed a jump in profits, said to be down to a boost in speciality medicines for asthma and HIV. Turnover grew by 4% to £32.7 billion last year. And the snooker player John Virgo has died at the age of 79. After winning the UK Championship in 1979, he went on to be well known as a broadcaster and particularly as a commentator, including for his catchphrase, "Where's the cue ball going?" For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
If you had a catchphrase, what would it be? Here's the news and sport. Yes.
We're late again to the news and sport. That would be my catchphrase.
I'm sure we can think of a better one. In this half an hour of the programme, we do have our new sport slot. It's with Vassos Alexander. Every day we'll be talking about something sporting, something that's hitting the news. It won't just be a football roundup or a tennis roundup or a cricket roundup or a rugby roundup. It's going to be more thoughtful than that. Thank you for all of your suggestions and what we should call it. We still haven't landed on one, have we?
I thought we were going with sport thought.
Sport thought,
or
okay.
Thought sport. Yeah. Mary, thank you for your message. She's reminded us that FIFA is implementing mandatory 3-minute hydration breaks during the Men's World Cup next summer. Apparently, these breaks will allow for extra coach communication and commercial opportunities. So maybe there will be ads.
Interesting.
Disgusting. I'm disgusted.
OK.
But thank you, Mary.
That could be your catchphrase, actually, Jane.
Actually, no, it could be. I'm disgusted.
It is 5 minutes past three. The big story remains the same today. Keir Starmer says Peter Mandelson repeatedly lied to his team about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein and that he regrets appointing him as ambassador to the US in 2024. It comes as the recently released files appear to show that Mandelson also lobbied the Obama administration to water down banking restrictions after a request from Epstein. As more and more comes out about those connected to the former financier and convicted paedophile, let's speak to Vicky Ward, an investigative journalist who spent decades reporting on Jeffrey Epstein. Vicky wrote a profile of him for Vanity Fair back in 2003. It was due to include allegations of abuse from Maria and Annie Farmer, who filed the earliest known complaints against him. But those allegations were later redacted. Vicky joins us now. Very good afternoon, Vicky. Thank you for your time. Can you just tell us a little bit more about what happened with that piece?
Yeah, of course. And thank you for having me. You know, what happened with that piece, you know, is fairly straightforward, actually. Maria and Annie Farmer told me what had happened to them at the hands of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. I spoke, not, and they went on the record. So did their mother. So did a well-known artist, Eric Fischel. And so did a fairly well-known businessman at the time. And I think even by today's standards, you know, that is to have three first-hand witnesses who were told contemporaneously by the Farmer Sisters what had happened to them, you know, should meet editorial standards. Jeffrey Epstein, obviously, and Ghislaine Maxwell went berserk, and there's documentation, actually, of this that are in the latest Epstein files that have been released. You see Jeffrey Epstein writing to my boss, Graydon Carter, to complain about me, and you see there's also a fax that I found last night that he sent to me telling me what a dreadful journalist I was. And he also, but behind my back, went to see Graydon Carter in the offices of Vanity Fair, after which the Farmer Sisters and their allegations were cut from the article that was published in February. It was in the March 2003 edition of the magazine.
How did all of that leave you feeling?
Well, I was, frankly, in floods of tears. I remember it like it was yesterday. I was furious for myself. I was very, very worried and frightened for the Farmer Sisters, because I had effectively exposed them now to Ghislaine Maxwell and to Jeffrey Epstein. I had exposed the fact that they had told the magazine what had happened. And because we hadn't gone to press, we hadn't given them any sort of protection. And Maria Farmer's life went on to be miserable because, you know, she has said that Ghislaine Maxwell went on to threaten her. It was a great cost to me, the stress and the anxiety of this. I already had a very complicated pregnancy, and I went into labor much too soon with my twins, and at 30 weeks. So I produced minuscule babies weighing 2 pounds and just under 3 pounds each. They both had health issues and had to be in the hospital for 2 months. And Jeffrey Epstein had threatened them when I was pregnant. And we had to ask for extra security at the neonatal ward because, you know, and we had to explain that as nutty as it sounded, this strange man had made these threats. We didn't really know who he was or what his background was, but, it, you know, we were frightened. And the worst thing, obviously, as we all know, is that it left Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell completely unchecked to carry on with the abuse. And it meant that hundreds more children got abused because it then I did get a call from the FBI, but not until well over a year later. And then the FBI investigation took a long time until eventually, as we know, Epstein ended up with that ridiculous cushy plea deal in 2008. But a lot of the crime and harm could have been avoided if we had put the Farmer Sisters into that published article.
How are the Farmer Sisters now?
Well, I think, you know, Annie Farmer, who testified at Ghislaine Maxwell's criminal trial, has been front and centre in you know, lobbying Congress. I think she's been front and centre when the survivors have gone to Capitol Hill. She's been very high profile on the media, pushing for Congress to do the right thing over this. And I think she's been front and centre saying that what's happened is not remotely good enough, and has been deeply re-traumatizing and triggering for herself and for other victims. Yeah. And, you know, she herself is a therapist. I mean, she has considerable expertise in all of this, aside from her own personal history.
You've watched this unravel over 20 years, Vicky, but it just hasn't unraveled enough. And the huge scandal, along with the fall of people like Peter Mandelson, is that only one person is in jail for the exploitation or abuse or sexual assault of minors. I mean, that is a fact, isn't it? And it is a really, really shocking fact.
Yeah, it's an appalling fact. And I think a real, there's, you know, the problem in part has to do with the way that the American justice system works. You know, I think it's funny, it's not without good reason that the two figures that in a way have paid the biggest price are British, actually. Because in America, you know, what tends to happen is the government, in order to pursue big criminals, does deals with little ones. And I think that, you know, Ghislaine Maxwell does talk in her habeas corpus petition as part of her appeal about 25 men who did private civil settlements with survivors because they knew that there was a fear of criminal prosecutions. And this is something that I'd heard all along, that there were these settlements done in the dark between survivors and other men in Jeffrey Epstein's circle. And I think it's quite clear, we know who they are from. We know the names. They're all over these you know, releases from the DOJ. But, you know, this is how the government work. They flip people, they flip the small fish in order to get to the big fish. And I think that is exactly what happened in this case.
Yeah.
Not, I mean, it's not irrelevant, by the way, that back in the early 1990s, in fact, Jeffrey Epstein flipped for the government in order to put his then boss, Steve Hoffenberg, who was convicted of the biggest Ponzi scheme in American history prior to Bernie Madoff. Jeffrey Epstein worked with Hoffenberg, and Jeffrey Epstein testified to the government, which meant that Jeffrey Epstein never went to jail for the, these were the financial crimes that he was part of. So this unfortunately is how the system works.
Yep. And Jeffrey Epstein himself had offered a kind of, would we call it a plea bargain for the sentence that he was serving when he died. But there were many, many other convictions that he did the deal on, weren't there?
Right. That's exactly right. And, you know, again, I mean, there is, he was very, very clever. We do see that these documents are enlightening, actually, in regard to how that plea deal went down. I mean, you can see that the lawyers that he had on his team were people who would go on to work with Alex Acosta, the U.S. attorney in Miami at the time. You know, Alex Acosta, it was in his personal interest to work with them because he then went into private practice with one of them, Jay Lefkowitz. And you can see there's an email in which the names are redacted. Of course, they are protecting the government officials, the Justice Department officials, in which they go back and forward when in 2011 they're being queried about this plea deal by Brad Edwards, the lawyer who went on to represent many of Epstein's victims,
yeah,
saying, pushing them on how they could have done this deal behind the victims' backs, which turned out to be illegal. And you see in the email these unnamed officials digging in, saying, look, we know it wasn't a good deal, but that's not the point. We have to stick to our guns and say we were robbed. We didn't legally have to tell the victims. They knew it wasn't a good deal. They knew that it was absurd and cushy. One kind of justice for rich people and a completely different kind of justice for poor people.
Sure. So we have all of those legal deals there, Vicky, but there's also what seems to be the unwritten deal of boys' club, which is, yeah, that you just don't talk about boys' club. And I think it's very interesting that Melissa French Gates was asked, Bill Gates' ex-wife, on a podcast, yeah, in the last couple of days for some kind of comment about this. And she said, all of this talk brings up a very, very painful series of memories for me about my marriage. But you have to go and ask him. You have to go and ask the man these questions. And it is women who are talking about this and trying to tell their stories, and it is not the men. Do you think that there will be a man who will break ranks and actually confirm what happened, what they saw, when they saw it, who was there? Will that ever happen, do you think?
I wish. I really doubt it. I mean, I think the level of misogyny that has emerged from a much wider swathe of men than even I realised. You know, Brad Karp, guy I know, respected lawyer, head of an enormous law firm in the US, Paul Weiss. There's an email from Epstein to him saying, you know, can I help you, you know, protect your client, Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots football team, when Robert Kraft was caught soliciting prostitution at a Chinese massage parlor in Palm Beach. And, you know, Kraft replying, and Brad Karp replies back, he's going to need the best. You know, he came out and apologized yesterday because until these documents came out, nobody knew that he had been corresponding and obviously knew Epstein well. The disgusting emails between Steve Tisch, who I also know, the owner of the Giants football team, and Epstein, you know, saying, well, if you're going to, is this woman a pro or a civilian? I mean, come on. And the answer is no, they've been caught. They've been caught and they're sheepish and they're ashamed. Are they going to change their ways? I doubt it. And I think the whole thing is sickening proof for women of how all these men, you know, men in this social and wealth milieu, this elite plane, think of women as just objects. It's disgusting.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us this afternoon. So much to think about there. And I think you're absolutely right, Vicky. That is Vicky Ward, investigative journalist who has spent decades, as you heard, reporting on Jeffrey Epstein. And, you know, the way that the women are talked about just as commodities, I think there is something in seeing those personal emails, Jane, that really brings home to everybody, and the pictures that are emerging that bring home to everybody how irrelevant those women's lives were to the men who became involved with them, paid for them, and then, you know, just dispensed with them.
I think they barely thought of them as human, thought of them as barely human. It would be, wouldn't it be great if one of them did, at least one came out and said something.
Yeah, and I said, mean, you know,
look, I'm really sorry.
I've now realised, you know, that I was part of something that, you know, that I maybe knew deep down at the time was wrong, but I went along with it because X, Y, and Z were there. Mm. They all said, no, this is fine. You know, we've all been prey to that kind of pressure.
Well,
not that kind of pressure, no. But we've all been prey to a kind of pressure
mentality.
In our lives, and we understand that. And I think you're right, for one man to, you know, turn tail and head towards decency wouldn't be a bad thing.
Yeah, lots of men like to tell us they're brave. Well, show us how brave you are. And if you're in a bolt hole in Norfolk and you want to do the decent thing and fly to the States, I'm sure there are plenty of flights available from a scintillating range of British airports. Right, it's 20 past three. We're going to talk to Vassos Alexander about sport, as we do every day, Monday to Thursday at around this time. And we're going to focus on the Winter Olympics, and particularly Lindsay Vonn, who is back, although she has done her, she's ruptured her anterior cruciate ligament, but she still wants to ski for the States in the Winter Games. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes. The kitchen and bathroom sale's now on. Explore all the sale offers at wickes.co.uk or visit your local Wickes store.
Global events.
There are real worries about security, about human rights.
Keeping you informed as events unfold.
We are going to be asking a question that would have been unimaginable 48 hours ago.
Reactive analysis.
The scandal here is that of misconduct in a public office. That's the claim here.
From the world's best journalists.
This is what you get. Big thoughts from people with big brains.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
What is it that makes a Fred Olsen cruise feel like no other? Perhaps it's the awe-inspiring destinations that will stay with you forever. Or our ships that are small in size, but big in character. It could be the wonderful people you meet along the way. Or our extraordinary crew. Maybe it's all of these things together. But if you really want to know what a Fred Olsen cruise feels like, there's only one way to find out.
McDonald's wraps, all flavour, no mess. No drips on your drip or grease on your shirt. No crumbs on your keyboard or sauce on your dashboard. Just all the flavour of sweet chilli chicken, barbecue and bacon chicken and new Tikka chicken. Wrapped up neat. Served after 11 a.m. Tikka chicken wrap available until the 13th July 26. Fees apply to delivery orders, subject to availability.
Download the Free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Let the design and installation experts at Wix help transform your home. Get started by booking a free kitchen or bathroom design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Welcome. Welcome back, Vassos. I tell you what, we've had some chatterboxes on the show today. Ryan Tubridy and now Vassos Alexander. Oh, by the way,
do they know their timings upstairs on Virgin Radio? Hard ins and outs.
Hard entries, hard outs. Lots of people just saying Vicky Ward was amazing. Can you get her back? And we're going to, aren't we? We're going to make sure that we have Vicky on because this Epstein story is, to put it mildly, it's going to keep going. I think we all know that, don't we? And it could have all kinds of repercussions for all sorts of people.
And she has had a prime viewing seat for the last 24 years, so she really does know what she's
trying to bring this man down. Obviously he's dead now, but it still rumbles on. So that was Vicky Ward, if you didn't catch her name. She was talking to Fee just a couple of minutes ago. So to the sport and Vassos, and according to the American skier Lindsey Vonn, it's perfectly possible to ski down a mountain at more than 80 miles an hour if you're not perfectly fit. I can't believe she's doing this. She's 41. She's the American skier. She's going to be racing this Sunday, 9 days after she had a crash which ruptured her ACL and she had to be airlifted to hospital. Why?
I mean, she is extraordinary. Lindsey Vonn is just one of those people that if you meet, I've never met Lindsey Vonn personally, but she'd be one of those people that I would be slightly in awe of. She has a habit of skiing down a mountain in the manner of a wardrobe falling off a cliff. She doesn't really take her. She says she takes her own safety seriously, but you know, the amount of broken bones that she's accumulated in her career would tend to tell a different story. Okay. I had a look about how long a Premier League footballer would take if they had ruptured an ACL.
Yep.
How long until they're back on a Premier League football pitch? About 9 to 12 months is the answer. Not 9 to 12 days, Lindsey Vonn. By the way, this is her third torn ACL of her career. She's also torn an MCL, 4 tibial plateau fractures, whatever they are. In Andorra, she basically smashed up multiple fractures of her left knee. She did that 8 months later again, multiple fractures of that knee. She retired in 2019 with some nerve damage. And then 5 years later, she'd had a knee replacement and thought, you know what? Let's go again. And she's leading the World Cup standings in downhill coming into these Winter Olympics.
So she's in form.
She's absolutely in form. She's one of the all-time great skiers. She's 41 years of age now. I mean, golf fans know her because she had a very high-profile 3-year relationship with Tiger Woods just after his marriage split up. I mean, she's her. As they say in America, she's her in American sport. And she, I mean, without this torn ACL, all attention would be on Lindsey Vonn returning to the Olympic Games, age 41. But just the fact that she did it, she was airlifted to hospital with a torn ACL. And she's already been thinking about, you know, practicing on the downhill course ahead of Sunday's race. Amazing.
Right. I mean, it is phenomenal.
It is, but does there ever come a time when anybody intervenes and says, actually, you shouldn't do that in the name of sport?
I mean, I asked Sir Tony McCoy the same question because he broke, I think, every bone in his body at some stage falling off horses before he retired. And he said, it goes with the job. But I mean, it's a pretty heavy price to pay, isn't it?
I was going to say, I wonder whether the true price is paid perhaps in your 60s and 70s where your body is just aching and you're, I mean, who knows? And I don't wish that on Lindsay or anybody else who's delight. I mean, I love sport, but people who take part in it professionally often end up paying quite the price, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and this is just broken bones and broken bones heal. Mm. There's also, you know, big discussions in sport at the moment about concussions.
Yes, heading the ball.
And heading the ball, rugby concussions and, you know, and the long-term effects of that. So it's very much, you know, sports great, like you say, but ...
Yeah, OK. Now, Britain, I've been talking about this, Team GB are expected to do better than usual. In fact, possibly putting in their best ever performance, aiming for what?
seven or eight medals, we're told.
Yes, yeah, so this is UK Sport who dish out the money to Olympic athletes, and then they set how many medals they'd like from each Games. And it's not a hard and fast rule, but they say, look, this is you know, we have certain number of kind of podium people that we would expect to get some medals, and a certain number of, you know, finals and that. And so they've said seven or eight, which would be great for Team GB. Curling, we're very good at curling. In fact, we start curling today. The opening ceremony is on Friday in Milan, but today is officially day minus two, which is the day that the action actually gets underway with Team GB's curlers in mixed doubles action against Norway at 6:05 our time.
Right, well, I'm already excited. But we need news desperately of the Spanish figure skater who wants to perform to music and sounds from the Minions movie. Now, he's been allowed to use the backing track after first being blocked by copyright rules. So here's a quick reminder. Well, to be honest, that was enough. You better be a great dancer, because that's awful. Sorry, it's terrible music. What's the story here?
I mean, look, have a look at him. Here he is. He's called Gariano Sabate. He skates in a Minions costume, like sort of jeans and dungarees and a yellow T-shirt.
But he hasn't got the big glasses.
He doesn't have the big glasses. He doesn't. I mean, I speak as somebody who has run 3 London marathons dressed as a Minion. So
why?
I do know. I know. Oh, do you know why?
Why?
Because it creates an awful lot of joy on the sidelines. You know, the kids looking everywhere from Greenwich to the Mall going, look, Mummy, Daddy, a Minion. And if they then get high-fived by said Minion, which they all do, by the way, then it just makes the day pass quicker, and actually the miles for me pass quicker. And, you know, he obviously likes the movies, this guy, and he's been skating to this all through, you know, on the circuit all year. And then suddenly he gets told, oh, no, you can't do that, which would have been a massive problem for him. But Universal Studios. So this, by the way, you know, we've got 2.5 weeks of the Winter Olympics.
Yeah,
this is an absolute, this is a cast iron Winter Olympics story. Spanish figure skater in Minions.
Yeah, you're right. It's the boxes are ticked,
yeah,
here.
Yes.
They really are.
I mean, you know, I was thinking about back to Winter Olympics stories. I mean, it started, of course, with the Jamaican bobsleigh team and Eddie the Eagle. But you remember there was a speed skater, an Aussie speed skater called Stephen Bradbury, who was last in his race and only reached the final. He was in the semi-finals and only reached the final because everyone else fell on the final corner. So suddenly he's through to the final. And then in the final, he's miles last, and everyone else fell on the final corner.
He rather sheepishly
won a gold medal.
Wow.
This is the sort of thing that happens at the Winter Olympics.
Oh, these are great stories. And actually, I think at the last Winter Games, which we established earlier, we're in
Beijing.
Britain was expected to do better and sort of narrowly missed in a number of sports. So maybe our luck's in this time.
Yes, so Bruce Mowat, who's the mixed doubles curler who's in action today with,
yep,
Jen Dodds, he was one of those people who just they were nailed on to do a medal, mm, and then they just got nerves got to them in the semi-finals and then just missed out. And there was a lot of that sort of stuff going on for, yeah, Team GB 4 years ago. So here's hoping.
Well, it won't happen. What about Matt Weston in the men's skeleton? He's a dead cert. Apparently he is, I read.
Yes. Well, here's the thing. You know that the luge and the bobsleigh, right, the skeleton is on a tray, but head first, mm-hmm, down the mountain. And we are, since Amy Williams, we are really good at that. And
who'd,
yes,
have thought it? The British people were good at going head first down a very slippery slope on a tray.
At 85 miles an hour on the ice.
That is terrifying. That is terrifying. I was watching a report about the men's bobsleigh team, and they said it's very, very rare that they ever actually practice on a proper bobsleigh run. When they're doing training in this country, there's just no snow, there's no ice, there's no nothing.
No, they practice in Bath.
Yeah. which also, I mean, I suppose it is a bit hilly, isn't it? It's not very hilly, though, in Bath.
I mean, it's that first few seconds where they all run and push the bobsleigh and then practice getting in. Mm. That is absolutely crucial. It's only the driver, really, who needs to practice on the run itself. And they always do the visualisation and, you know, corner one, corner two and all of this. And they've got it in their mind. But the others are just raw power, just sprints. Because 1 second at the top is 3 seconds at the bottom in the bobsleigh.
Wow. Fascinating. Thank you, Vassos. A very, very nanosecond of a word on ads during the Six Nations.
So this is happening as of this Six Nations on ITV. I mean, not obviously at halftime. This is during the match, during
live
play.
Yeah,
and instinctively you think, oh no, here we go. But, you know, I was reading Owen Slott's piece in The Times just now on the app, and he said, you know, the broader picture here is rugby as a sport fighting to keep its relevance. If the odd ad before they reset a scrum, and it's going to be an L-shaped on two-thirds of the screen, crucially, the audio will come from the advert, not the commentary. So you'll be able to see the, hopefully, not too much action going on as they're resetting a scrum or preparing to take a line out. But there will be one in each half, an advert. And, you know, this has happened in US sport for decades, actually. So, honestly, we've done well to hold out as long as we have.
OK, purists, brace yourselves. It's coming. Vassos, thank you very much. Vassos is with us Monday to Thursday here on Times Radio. If you want more on that story, the rugby one, I mean, you can go to thetimes.com, head to the sports section.
Keith, we'll get to your lovely message right after we hear the very latest news headlines. Slightly tardy for them. Our apologies. 3:32. Here's Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister has admitted he was warned about Peter Mandelson's continued friendship with Jeffrey Epstein in vetting when appointing him ambassador to Washington. Sir Keir Starmer says Lord Mandelson lied repeatedly during that process and says the government will release vetting documents to prove that. However, MPs are warning of a cover-up because ministers are insisting on redacting those documents so they don't prejudice national security or international relations. The former Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner says Parliament's Security Committee should decide instead.
In 2022, I proposed a humble address seeking information about PPE. Should we not have the ISC not have the same role now in keeping public confidence in the process?
Six Palestine Action activists have been cleared of aggravated burglary over a break-in at an Israeli arms company. They're on trial over the incident at Elbit Systems factory in Bristol in August 2024. A 76-year-old man who sexually assaulted two boys at a summer camp in Leicestershire has admitted drugging his wife so she wouldn't wake up while he did so. John Rubin has also previously admitted child cruelty against six other victims. And inquests into the death of five babies Lucy Letby was convicted of murdering have been opened and adjourned. They died at the Countess of Chester Hospital in 2015 and 2016. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
I thought I'd seen it all, then felt myself awaken. I thought I'd witnessed beauty before my breath was taken. I thought that I'd known wonder, then sailed beneath these skies. I thought I'd seen the world until I opened my eyes. Change the way you see the world with HX Expeditions. Search Travel HX to discover more.
When you leave a gift in your will to guide dogs, where could it lead? It might lead to our specialists helping someone regain their independence, like Jenny.
I'd just gone from everything to nothing. She gave me my freedom back. She gave me my confidence back.
Your gift to guide dogs could lead to a future where lives are transformed. Find out how to make your life-changing will for free. Search Guide Dogs, Free Wills.
Guide Dogs. Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Are you dreaming of a new kitchen? Let Wix guide you through the wide range of stunning styles, appliances and worktops. Kitchens start from under £3,000. Get started by booking your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
So from Keith comes this. Hello. Not all blokes, men are non-human beings. Some of us, I hope and believe most of us, are disgusted by the behaviour of these people involved in the Epstein case. The truth should come out and light shone on this darkness, but guys like me would hold the torch that shines the light. Please remember that we are here too. Well, it's a lovely point to make, Keith, and we've been saying for years, haven't we, that actually one of the most obvious solutions to the problem of misogyny has to come from nice, decent men, you know, doing a little bit of welly towards the not nice, indecent men, because you are closer to that problem. And it is just a fact that sometimes when you hear women complaining about men, some men switch off. So if the men can complain about that too, then all well and good. So we completely hear you, Keith, and I suppose we should say it's nice to have you on board.
It is. It is Times Radio. We welcome all contributions. 0333 003 2353. It's 25 minutes thereabouts. I get confused at this time to four. Steve Crawshaw is our guest this afternoon. Fantastic to have you in the studio with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You are the author of Prosecuting the Powerful, War Crimes and the Battle for Justice, a timely book which is out in paperback tomorrow. Justice is very much in the air at the moment, yeah. Or sometimes you feel lack of it, quite honestly. Steve is the former chief foreign correspondent at The Independent and was UK director of Human Rights Watch. You've also worked for Freedom from Torture as
and
well.
And Amnesty International, correct.
Yes. And Amnesty, okay. Yeah. So a man with impeccable credentials. I should say that on the cover of the book are three men, Putin, Netanyahu and al-Assad. Now, two are still in power, one's in exile in a luxury tower block, presumably in Moscow. Will they ever face justice, do you think?
This is, as you say, it's the kind of the question at the heart of everything, really. And so I guess the short answer to all of that is none of us can know for certain. I mean, there are no immediate ways of getting our hands on any of those three. But I think it's worth dipping back into history briefly of, like, so many of the big conflicts that we've seen, it seemed nothing would ever happen. And for me, a kind of central moment in my own biography, my own life, but also in a sense for the storytelling of the book, was when I was a journalist, as you mentioned, at The Independent. I was covering the Balkans and I met Slobodan Milosevic, the then Serb leader. The way that we met was pretty random itself, but we met in this fancy London hotel and I kind of bluffed my way in different ways. Sat down with him. This was 1992, the very beginning of the Bosnian War, and I was just back from a trip to Sarajevo. And people had just started to mention the possibility of a war crimes tribunal. So at the end of a longer interview on other themes, I said, by the way, what about this? Oh, yes, a marvellous idea. And I said, yeah, but what about you, Mr. President, mind you? And me? No, I am for peace. And that meeting was very memorable to me for lots of different reasons. But I remember thinking afterwards, not only did he feel confident he would never face justice, but I also thought it could never happen. And yet, if you like, quote unquote, only 9 years later, he landed up there. Within the past year, we had the former president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte. He was trotting around Hong Kong saying, come and get me if you like, to the International Criminal Court in The Hague, who had put out an arrest warrant for him. Yeah, come and get me. He flies back into Manila and sure enough, handcuffs are put in and he is flown to The Hague and he's about to go on trial there in The Hague. So we never know. To go to the three that you mention, Assad is now in Moscow, as you say, living in luxury, but he's disposable goods now. He has no value to Russia, really, so there's lots of reasons why. And Putin and Netanyahu, very, very interesting. Both of them have had to change their travel plans in the last couple of years. Yeah. They couldn't go to South Africa, couldn't do this, couldn't do that.
That's all they've had to do.
That's absolutely right. That's so far. But the same could have been said of Milosevic in 1995 or 1996.
So don't give up hope.
Give up hope, really. And what it means is the pressures and where does the society itself go? So Israel at the moment, there's not great love for Netanyahu, to put it mildly. Before 7th of October, of course, there was even less. And I think it's a question of does Israeli society come to that sense of, actually, this guy really should be put on trial, not just for the sake of the Palestinians who've died, but for Israeli society, for the stability, the security of the future. The same kind of journey that other countries have been on, thinking actually accountability does really matter.
We should also say that actually, haven't Hamas also been indicted?
They have, exactly. And that's really important. It's not like either or. Of course, Hamas leaders were indicted for the horrendous crimes, not only, but especially the horrendous crimes of 7th of October. And those terrible crimes clearly, well, they're so obviously very, very serious crimes. What is odd sometimes is when you get the narrative, well, they've done all these awful things, so therefore somehow the other side, in a way that trumps, and it doesn't. That's, of course, not the way justice works. A crime is a crime,
sure,
whoever has committed it.
Goodness me, though. I mean, this book was such an education because there are so many grey areas, and perhaps we could talk about how the USA conducted itself after 9/11, because that was obviously a seismic and terrible event, But how did the USA react?
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? So as older listeners will remember, we kind of lived through that period, although it's slightly slid into history and been forgotten. So, as you say, horrendous, the attacks of 9/11, so dreadful and so brutal. And the then US administration, their takeaway from that was, well, they've done terrible things, so we need to go on what was called the dark side. And how dark it was of torture was just completely normalized. Things that the Americans themselves had prosecuted at the Tokyo Tribunal, for example, after 1945, waterboarding. That was a crime then, and of course remained a crime, but no, that's okay. And again, first morally and legally, it was completely wrong. But what they were so slow to understand, but I hope has now been accepted in the meantime, looking back, was it, of course, made life more dangerous. It made the world a less secure place. The photographs that came out of Abu Ghraib, the prison in Iraq, where terrible torture had been committed constantly and people took the photos of it, and those got leaked eventually. Those, not only were those shocking to those who cared about such crimes, but it also fueled violence in the years to come.
Terrorists were born.
And so that I did quite a lot of traveling during the, when I was writing the book. I went to Ukraine several times. This past year I was in Syria after the fall of Assad. Amazing to people pressing for justice there. But I was also in Israel in the West Bank and met inspiring Israeli human rights lawyers and activists who were saying we need to have the accountability for these crimes, because how are we going to be living in some kind of safety and security in the years to come? You know, the 10-year-old now who's lost both his or her parents in Gaza, what are they going to be doing in a decade's time? You need to think that you need some kind of closure. To quote the chief US prosecutor at Nuremberg, Robert Jackson, he talked about the importance of Nuremberg because it could stay the hand of vengeance. Well, and that phrase, I think, is so resonant today.
A lot of people say Nuremberg was, what's the expression, victor's justice.
Yes.
And again, something I learned from the book, of course, Britain and other allies, we did not behave impeccably in World War II. We did win. We were on the winning side.
Yes.
And therefore, our carpet bombing of German civilians was not part of what went on at Nuremberg.
Yeah.
So, and the Germans were not, they weren't in the dock either for their bombing campaigns. Is that right?
That's right. So it was precisely because of what you've just described.
Yeah.
So initially, when the planning was first happening of, you know, the war hadn't been won yet by any means, but earlier in the war, it's like, okay, this terrible bombing raids, not just on Britain, of Coventry, London and elsewhere, but in Minsk, in Belgrade, a whole bunch of Warsaw, lots of Nazi bombing, which took no account of civilians and therefore was already on the list. But by the time it got to 1945, more than 500,000 people had died in the Anglo-American raids. Most famously in Dresden, about 30,000, but Hamburg was pretty much as big, and lots of other raids across the country. And it was like, well, we can't really accuse them of those things because obviously the finger will then be pointed at us. So that was dropped out. And you're quite right. The phrase victor's justice has been used often of Nuremberg. And in some obvious ways, like the one that you've just mentioned there, it was. But it was also a foundation stone. The defence worked really hard, and there were some acquittals at Nuremberg. People often forget this, were acquittals.
So what sort of people were acquitted?
The people who'd been, if you like, the pen pushers a bit. Now, pen pushing can actually, in its most extreme version, absolutely be like Adolf Eichmann, who was later went on trial in Jerusalem much later. But he, you know, he'd never pulled the trigger or done something physical, but he was responsible for organising. But more generally, people who were, yeah, they were around, but they weren't maybe directly involved, those people were ended up being acquitted.
And
civil servant types.
Right. The Russians were never, I mean, what went on in Berlin, for example, when the Red Army got there, is something that people still find, I gather, incredibly difficult to discuss.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, now it is discussed in Germany, in Russia, it's a complete taboo. The rape that happened during that time, I mean, so many, it was just horrific. And that was a complete taboo for many years. It was to do in, to some extent, in Germany, German society, although much later a book that had been written at the time was published. And more generally, it wasn't known. And then there was a great book written by Anthony Beaver about 20 years ago now, the historian, who, writing about downfall of Berlin, laid a lot of this out, including drawing on Russian archives, archives which would now be closed, but at that time were open up. So there was a lot of that stuff that was going on. But nonetheless, I say Nuremberg was a foundation stone, even if there were things that you left out.
Right. So let's fast forward to 2002 and the establishment of the International Criminal Court. Who actually worked to make it happen?
I love these stories. And in a sense, although there's so much darkness that we're facing today in many, many different ways, and you constantly hear people say, oh, the whole thing is gone, it's all lost, nothing can be achieved. Now, it is true that we're facing a lot of darkness. But the idea of an international criminal court seemed utterly unachievable. It was first floated way back in the 19th century when the Geneva Convention started coming up. And the first Geneva Convention was in place, but one of the guys responsible for that said, yeah, but they don't kind of obey it. We need to have enforceability. Well, the governments which had, just like today, the governments which had signed the convention didn't actually want it to be enforceable. So that went nowhere. At different points, the idea was there. At the time of Nuremberg and immediately after, and especially with the creation of the Genocide Convention, 1948, which was due to an absolute obsessive character, Raphael Lemkin, who Philip Sands has written about brilliantly in East West Street. At that time, it's like, well, if we have a genocide convention, it needs to be enforced somewhere, so we must have an international court. But of course, all the powerful governments were not interested in a place. So what I describe in the book is some of these visionary types who often describe themselves as Don Quixote figures. One was A&R Robinson, Ray Robinson, who was a law student from Trinidad and Tobago. He was studying at Oxford, and his a fellow student, American Robert Wurzel, was writing a PhD on, writing his thesis on the Nuremberg trials, and both of them chatted together and said, like, why would you just have one trial? You need to have the possibility of doing it for the future. Now, that could just seem like, you know, student conversations in the pub, but they both remained obsessed with that in different ways. Ray Robinson, A&R Robinson, became Prime Minister and then President of Trinidad and Tobago. And that's where you have the sweetness of history coming together, because as he became Prime Minister of his country, it was just the time when everything else was changing. The Berlin Wall was coming down. So in autumn 1989, during the very weeks that the Berlin Wall came down and everything else was up for grabs, if you like, he put onto the agenda of the United Nations saying, we need to have an international criminal court. So he asked for that in 89, a few years passed, and then in Rome in 1998, despite the hatred of the US for the idea, but it happened, it was agreed in Rome in 98 and then became real, as you say, right, in 2002.
And is it now under threat because of the current American administration?
It really is. So George W. Bush didn't like it, and he came up with something called it was colloquially called the Hague Invasion Clause. In other words, the idea, if you ever dare to seize an American for whatever reason, we will invade The Hague. It was kind of just rhetoric in those days. It was an absurd, it was dark rhetoric, but it was never going to happen. But Trump has taken it way forward. He's put on a series of sanctions on both prosecutors, on judges, and he's trying basically to suffocate the court itself. Incredibly dangerous, because this is the institution that's been created and has described Don Quixote figures over so many years went for it. It would be impossible to recreate if it's crushed. And for me, it's a sadness. Obviously, it's dark that an elected US president can want to destroy an institution which is fundamental about the rule of law. But not only that, we've seen almost complete silence from the European governments, all of whom, including Britain, all the European Union governments, were all part of creating that court. And now they kind of sit and go, and haven't managed to find their voice.
Yeah, well, we're all operating double standards, aren't we?
I mean, sadly.
Ursula von der Leyen, I think she's been very vocal condemning Putin and the invasion of Ukraine, but less keen on saying too much about Netanyahu.
Yes, exactly. And although it was sometimes almost exactly the same crimes you described, you know, attacks on infrastructure, the starvation, those kind of crimes, of course, were exactly what we saw later in Gaza.
So do you honestly think that the court will carry on?
I do think it can, but I do think it needs all of us to stand up for all of the countries. And of course, voters affect what politicians are thinking in some ways as well. And I think that it absolutely can survive. And it's interesting, you know, heard there's a key former senior British military prosecutor who was also very senior in the court resigned because some of the pressures. But he said, absolutely, we can. And I think when I talked earlier about how impossible things have happened, that's not just the creation of the court, but even as I began writing the book and talking to very, very wise heads then, he said, yeah, but so the Ukraine war had just begun and terrible crimes were being committed. Yes, but the president of a permanent member of the Security Council, they're never going to indict a man like that.
Isn't that...
But they then did.
They did, but...
And they indict, and they requested an arrest warrant, and then confirmed by the judges, 6 months later, issued arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and his defence minister, as well as the Hamas leaders, which we've described as well, which is, if you like, less complicated. But the fact that they said, we just do what we do. That's the point. Justice is supposed to be blind. You know, look at the statue on top of the courthouses. The idea is that you don't look at who's committed in making your choices. You look at what has happened, and then you go where the evidence leads you. So the court is trying to do that, and I think it's important. I hope that European leaders will stand up for that, understanding not just that it's legally important, but as described, that for the practicality of living in a safe world, you need institutions like that to exist.
Okay, and you also need people who are able and willing, brave enough to bear witness.
Yes.
To speak.
Is
that always possible?
That is so, so important. I'm glad you highlighted that one, because that was something which, in a way, was a bit of a learning curve, I think, for the International Criminal Court as well. You know, international justice, as we've just been discussing, is pretty new. You know, in the 1990s was the Hague Tribunal, former Yugoslavia, then on Rwanda, and then came the International Criminal Court, which kind of emerged from those. But in a way, it was still a lawyer's thing, and they weren't really thinking of the survivors. But in the meantime, the survivors' voices have been incredibly important. And it was interesting, when I spoke to the chief prosecutor of the court, and I said, who is your legal hero? And I expected him to say, you know, one of those names, perhaps, who helped to create Nuremberg or the courts, this, that, the other. And it turned out he did have some of those. But he said, my heroes are the people who come and stand and give testimony, knowing the difficulty of doing that is obvious to all of us. You know, the sexual violence, the rape, the killing, all of these things, you have to relive that and be questioned about it. But showing that courage and having the belief that by my giving testimony, perhaps I can help first bring this person to justice who's now in the dock, but also help for the future to stop those things happen. So I think that's unbelievably important. And those survivor voices and their role has become more and more important in the past 20 years.
I think so many people this week just feel something approaching despair about how justice only ever seems to be meted out to the small person.
Yes.
And the big guys just get away. They just get away with whatever they
like. It is odd to reflect on that. I mean, Prosecuting the Powerful, the title of this book, and I've been reflecting on that as you were saying earlier. I mean, it's so horrendous the way they have been protected. But I have to say, I do see parallels. I mean, before it seemed impossible a prime minister or a president or a former prime minister or former president could be prosecuted, and now that has definitely changed. Equally, the Epsteins and the Weinsteins and all of their friends, they were absolutely confident. But it is, of course, shocking to all of us reading those email exchanges, because they drip with the entitledness, which I guess makes all of us feel sick to the stomach. And I think there are significant parallels. Weinstein, of course, now is in jail, the Hollywood mogul, and Epstein died behind bars. But more generally, that's still a huge challenge. And I think it's interesting that those two things, those domestic crimes and those international crimes, of course, are different in some ways. But I think there's a real parallel of, if we try hard enough, we can do it. And again, there were, of course, individuals who bore testimony that helped with those cases, which, you know, with such courage that they came forward, initially ignored and eventually not ignored.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely huge respect to them. So interesting to talk to you. I mean, of the three on the cover, Putin, Netanyahu and Assad, who do you think is the most likely to end up behind bars in our lifetime?
That's a great question. I suppose I'd go for Assad because he has so little political value.
So the Russians could just...
And the Russians could say, you know what, we'd like this to happen economically. Please lift this and that and you're going to have Assad. But Netanyahu, very, very interesting to see where Israel... It's not a matter maybe of delivering to The Hague, but will Israel also say, you know what, we need to draw a line under this. I'm less confident. I myself, I studied Russian and I lived in Russia. I'm much less confident that Russia can get to, but that same place, I hope it can. But I do hope that we'll see some of those brought to justice eventually.
Really interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
For coming in today. Steve Crawshaw, Prosecuting the Powerful, War Crimes and the Battle for Justice. It's a fascinating paperback and it's out tomorrow.
That takes us to 4 minutes to four. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. You can book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Romantic retreats. Luxury beachfront hotels, expansive family villas with sensational sea views. Not lots of, just the very best of. Simpson Travel, the magical destinations you love, the personal service you expect. We visit every one of our properties so we can handpick the perfect holiday for you. SimpsonTravel.com, because your time is precious.
The Philly cheese stack is back at McDonald's and it's still intensely cheesy. Imagine the cheesiest thing ever. Now cover it in cheese. Add two beef patties, cheddar cheese sauce, crispy onions and even more cheese. The Philly cheese stack. Did we mention it's cheesy? Available until the 16th of March 2026 from 11 a.m. Fees apply to delivery orders. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Well, what a completely fascinating listen that was. And just to keep you tempted and fascinated, our guest tomorrow, completely and utterly different, Jane. Yeah.
By way of contrast, we've got
Michaela Strachan.
Well, I'm excited by that too.
No, very much so. So Variety is our middle name, although yours is also Susan, which is very, very confusing indeed.
I think I'd rather be called Jane Variety Barbie. I have said that before.
Yeah.
Say it again.
Yeah. Why not? We love a repeat. And some of you have gone a little bit too soon on the Wix Proud as a Peacock Award. We've had some entries during the programme today. Now just hold on to your DIY horses. You cannot enter to try and win £250 in Wix vouchers until we say you can, and that will be tomorrow afternoon between 2 and 4. We love your entries, though. If you've entered in the past and you haven't been successful, we really don't mind if you enter again.
Not at all. Just have a go. I mean, the goddess up there loves a trier.
Yes.
And we're the judges, so we appreciate people who try.
And it's very much in the spirit of the DIY competition, isn't it? To just keep trying.
Keep trying until you get it.
So yeah. Measure twice, cut once. We could just do enter twice, win once. That would do for us. That's it from us for today. We very much hope you enjoyed our programme. We had some fantastic interviewees actually on the programme today, so we very much hope that you kept listening. Our producer today was Hannah Quinn. Our technical operator was Adam Heaton. Up next, it is John Pienaar with Drive. Have a lovely evening when you get to it.
Have a good night.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Fee. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Angela Rayner leads Labour MPs in calling for independent oversight of what vetting Father Peter Mandelson are released by the government. And Bill Gates has admitted he was foolish to spend time with Jeffrey Epstein. Coming up, we're going to be checking on the continuing debate in the Commons. I'll be talking to a Labour backbench MP who's calling for an independent committee to have a role deciding which documents the government publishes on this. And you can hear my interview with the Polish Attorney General as the country launches an investigation into Jeffrey Epstein's suggested possible links to the Russian spy agency.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, John. Thank you. Labour MPs, including Angela Rayner, are calling for the government to let MPs decide which vetting files about Peter Mandelson are released. Sir Keir Starmer has admitted that vetting to be ambassador to Washington did flag Lord Mandelson's continued friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. The Prime Minister says he regrets appointing him to the role, but insists he was repeatedly misled.
Mandelson lied throughout the process and beyond the process. He lied, and he lied again to my team.
The Prime Minister says civil servants will decide which documents to release so that they don't prejudice national security or international relations. But the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says the government's trying to whitewash the documents and cover up for the Prime Minister.
His catastrophic lack of judgment, telling us now that he did know, has harmed the special relationship. It has endangered national security. It's not the humble address, it's him. It's compromised our diplomacy and it has embarrassed our nation.
MPs are continuing to debate the issue, with many calling for Parliament's Security Committee to decide what should be redacted instead. Bill Gates has admitted he was foolish to spend time with Jeffrey Epstein and says they were friends to try to help his charity work.
The focus was always he knew a lot of very rich people, and he was saying he could get them to give money to global health. You know, in retrospect, that was a dead end, and I've said many times, but I'll say again, I was foolish.
Those comments in an interview with the Australian Channel 9 News are his first since his ex-wife Melinda Gates said he had questions to answer. The Microsoft co-founder denied claims in the Epstein files that he caught an STD after having sex with Russian girls. Six Palestine Action activists have been cleared of aggravated burglary at a defence company linked to Israel. The break-in at Elbit Systems factory in Bristol happened in August 2024. The jury didn't reach a verdict on a charge of grievous bodily harm against one and three of violent disorder. A summer camp leader has pleaded guilty to drugging his wife last July so she wouldn't wake up while he sexually assaulted two boys. 76-year-old John Rubin has already admitted those assaults, as well as child cruelty towards six other children. An 18-year-old has been arrested on suspicion of murder after a stabbing in Leicester city centre. Times Radio's deputy head of news, Alex Dibble, has more.
Police were called just after 5 p.m. yesterday evening. They had received a report that a man had collapsed in Oxford Street in Leicester, which is close to De Montfort University. It was described earlier as a very serious incident that had happened on the campus of the university. We knew that students and staff who had witnessed the incident were being supported by specialists.
The Times reveals dozens of employers who were punished for abusing skilled worker visas have been given fresh permission to sponsor migrants. The Home Office insists that it does not tolerate abuse of the immigration system. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, the House of Commons, all the parties and all the MPs are rarely united. They don't often speak with a single voice, but today they were, and they did, in utterly condemning the former Labour, former peer and fallen political legend Peter Mandelson. Now, Keir Starmer led the chorus, calling Mandelson a liar. Too often to count, he had betrayed his country and his party, he said. He lied, and he lied again, said Starmer. If he'd had a dartboard with Mandelson's face on it and a dart, he'd have thrown it. The PM had already thrown out another chunk of red meat hacked from Mandelson's political carcass. He'd been stripped of his mainly ceremonial status as a member of the King's Privy Council. The problem for Starmer is that Peter Mandelson isn't the real target for opposition parties and MPs today. Starmer is. As I speak, MPs are debating the furore surrounding Mandelson and his ill-fated appointment as British ambassador to Washington. Conservatives, all the opposition parties, want every text, every message, every email, every note they can get their hands on about Mandelson's appointment as ambassador and everything else about him, from him and to him. Everyone, a potential club to batter Starmer and his government over the head. Point is that Starmer can't win. If the documents show the Prime Minister was told Mandelson was a friend to the billionaire, convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, and we all know that he was, it'll be used to batter Starmer's judgment for appointing him ambassador. Anything more that's embarrassing in the files when they're published will make it worse. The Prime Minister is promising to hold no document back unless it compromises national security or international relations. Cue accusation of cover-up. Heads, Starmer's critics win. Tails, Starmer loses. Is this, if you will forgive the mixed metaphor, another nail in the Prime Minister's political coffin? Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times. Tell me what you think. Or a tweet to at Times Radio. Now, earlier on at Prime Minister's question time, Keir Starmer was keen to demonstrate his anger at Mandelson.
Leaking sensitive information at the height of the response to the 2008 crash is beyond infuriating. And I am as angry as the public and any member of this House. Mandelson betrayed our country, our Parliament and my party. Mr. Speaker, he lied repeatedly to my team when asked about his relationship with Epstein before and during his tenure as ambassador. I regret appointing him. If I knew then what I know now, he would never have been anywhere near government.
Well, the Conservative Party leader Kemi Badenoch challenged the PM on his confidence in his chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, who's been linked to Peter Mandelson.
After all of this, does he have the same full confidence in Morgan McSweeney that he had in Peter Mandelson?
Prime Minister.
Morgan McSweeney is an essential part of my team. He helped me change the Labour Party and win an election. Of course I have confidence in him.
Well, the debate in the Commons on a demand for all the documents has been going since lunchtime. The former Deputy Labour leader, Deputy Prime Minister, formerly Angela Rayner, had this to say.
Given the public disgust and the sickening behaviour of Peter Mandelson and the importance of transparency, in 2022 I proposed a humble address seeking information about PPE, which the party opposite has listed and my honourable friend, the member for Hackney South, mentioned just before. Should we not have the ISC not have the same role now in keeping public confidence in the process?
Angela Rayner there. And Emily Thornberry, the Labour backbencher who chairs the Foreign Affairs Committee at Westminster, said she regretted her support for the appointment of Mandelson as ambassador.
I think the most important thing is that we asked several times. We asked straight away in January. We asked in February. We asked many times to have Lord Mandelson in front of the committee because we would have been able to ask those questions. And I do think that we perhaps would not be in the mess that we are in now if the Foreign Affairs Committee had been able to do its job